Chapter 52 The Mage Land of Sevendor. The trip home to Sevendor was almost leisurely, compared to the pace we'd been running at since we'd left. The siege of Sevendor, the conquest of Flaria, the end of the magic fair, the spellmonger's trial, and Sire Kay's wedding all seemed like years ago, but they were less than a moon in our past. The men who'd trudged off the barge at Sendaria Port were not the same men who had trudged into the Bailey of Sevendor Castle 3 weeks before. They had seen war, not as a frightened peasant in a siege, desperately defending their lives, but as warriors in the field, seeking and slaying the enemy where they found them. They were no longer Bovali peasants, or even Sevendori peasants. The men who had fled from Boval Vale with naught but the clothes on their backs had become something more in the heat of battle. They wore their snowflake tabards with a different attitude now. The new Sevendori had proven to themselves in battle that they were a fell people led by a powerful lord. It occurred to me as we were disembarking at Sendaria Port that they were not the only ones changed. Staring down that dragon's maw, being nearly dashed to pieces by its tail, I had brushed up against my mortality yet again. Only this time I had Alia and Minalian, and whomever the little bugger growing in my wife's belly turned out to be, who were depending on me. Not to die bravely in battle, but to protect them from everything, from hunger and poverty, to vengeful warlords and undead goblin heads. Without me standing between them and those dangers, they were vulnerable. That had been the sobering thought that had haunted me every mile up the river. Without me, where would my wife and son be? Sevendor was secure, such as I could make it, but it was far from being impregnable, even to mundane human attack. I was, much to my amazement, fabulously wealthy now, and that, at least, I could fix, if I was around to fix it. Because without me pushing to do it, who would? That was the crux of my problem. For the last 2 years, I had been running around trying to keep things moving, make things happen, and risked my life repeatedly in the process. Back then it seemed a small enough wager, but now I was not the only player at the table. If I fell now, then most of what I was working toward would fall with me. Not only would the new Sevendor Castle not be built, and the fate of my family would be in doubt, but there would be no strong leadership to guide it, to protect it, to advocate for the special nature of the place. Worse, in the long run, was what would happen to the war effort. The nascent arcane orders would likely collapse. Oh, Pentandra would do her best to keep them together, united, but she was no war mage. As competent and brilliant as she was, she could not boss Azar and Terlaman around like I could. She wasn't a war mage. While the Hessians and the smaller orders would likely follow her, without the Horkan order to provide an example of stability, they would start acting independently and eventually fighting among themselves. At least she'd have the Order of the Secret Tower on her side, if they could ever figure out exactly what they were supposed to be doing. The Censorate was already marshalling strength in Merwin and Vor, from the news I'd received in Barrowbell. The Duke of Merwin had reaffirmed their charter, and granted them even more power under his authority. A new Censor General had been elected, and by all reports he was a zealot about the bans. Even normal law-abiding magi were fleeing from the east. Without me and the arcane orders to offer them protection and recruit them for the war effort, they would be trouble. King Rad and his vicious family was otherwise occupied at the moment, which was a relief. Whatever their other machinations, they seemed to have gotten what they wanted from us magi and were leaving us alone, for now. But the spectre of Lady Isali's child was still out there, and I could not help but feel a chill down my spine every time I recall my conversation with the princess on Coronation Day. The family were uneasy allies at best, and I fully anticipated them turning on us eventually. Indeed, I was almost counting on it. Then there was our alliance, such as it was, with the Alka Alon. I was as suspicious about that as I was eager to exploit it, but I didn't understand it. Despite all we knew about the tree folk through literature, most of that knowledge was over 1,000 years old, predating humanity's appearance on Kalador. We knew almost nothing of their politics and strengths in the present. while absence of knowledge isn't proof of anything but ignorance, there had been several subtle suggestions I'd picked up from their conversations, such as knowing that there was a political split within the Alkan community, with one side favouring an alliance with humanity and the other side morally opposed. That would doubtlessly play a role in how the war played out. For whatever reason, the Alka-Alon had adopted me as their ambassador, and my possession of the only snowstone deposit on Kalador did give me some leverage with them, considering how eager they were to acquire and experiment with it. Such longevity as the Alka possess makes novelty a particularly precious coin. Snowstone was something new, magically speaking, and that had gotten their interest as much as the spectre of the dead god. But he was the ultimate reason I had to stay alive. I could not die in good conscience while that abomination existed. I had stood in its presence and felt the seething evil that had blighted reality in front of me. There was no negotiation with that hatred. With the power at his disposal, the dead god would not be stopped by anything less than his own destruction. The most I could hope for was to slow him down while we came up with a unique solution. Somehow I suspected that Snowstone would play a role in that, but I could not imagine how. It did underscore just how important my continuing to live was. With me, there was a chance we could last long enough to find a way to slay the unslayable. Without me? Well, maybe they could think of something, but I couldn't. One might say that's egocentric of me to think, but the big sphere of glowing green amber that floated around me all the time agreed with me. Besides, the one important lesson I'd learned in the last year was that I could not afford to worry about what other people thought about me. I was the Mage Lord of Sevendor, the Spellmonger. I had no peer. I was unique, and this was a unique time in history. The only way I could survive, and the only possible way I could triumph, was to keep that fact in mind. What I was doing has never been done before, and while I could take inspiration and instruction from others and from history, the plain no-nonsense fact of the matter was that I alone was in a position to judge my actions. That's a pretty scary thought, when you think about it long enough. But after attacking it from all sides, that was all I was left with. And if that course of action included a lot of egotistical nonsense due to my own quirky personality, posterity would just have to contend with that. By the time Tyndall had hired us fresh horses for our return journey, I was feeling better. Then I remembered that I no longer had my old friend Traveller with me, and I started feeling worse again. He wasn't the only one not coming back. Sevendor had bled for this war. Jerlord had lost a son and a nephew in the battle before the castle, and three of the Westwoodmen would not be returning to their forest home. Gurisham had lost 30 men of the 60 they'd sent, including Headman Brandine. Sevendor village had lost 4 more than that, and Bovell Hall had spent 66 lives in pursuit of their feud with the Gavanni. Southridge, Genly, Brastol, and Cowland's Pass had all given around a dozen men each, and the new domains under Sevendor's control had lost a few hundred. But the survivors were resilient. They formed up with something akin to military discipline when we departed Sendaria Port, marching with their spears and bows on their shoulders and their shields slung like hardened campaigners. Their matching green and white tabards looked impressive, and the purses of silver they had been paid dragged pleasantly heavy on their belts. There would be no empty bellies in Sevendor this winter.
"Master,"
Tyndall complained, as we rode past Chepstone Castle that evening, preparing to encamp for the night. "Why couldn't we tarry in Sendaria Port today? We barely arrived before we left, and there was little time to—" "Spend every coin you had on whores and drink," I supplied, helpfully.
"I was going to say relax and restore ourselves,"
he corrected me sourly. Somehow I think we were both talking about the same thing.
"But it seems a waste to let such a valuable shopping opportunity pass. Yule will be here before you know it,"
he reminded me. "So it will," I agreed. "That is why I spent far too much coin in Barrowbell doing my shopping. Some of it has already been sent to Sevendor. More will arrive soon. There is nothing more exotic in Sendaria Port than you'll find in Barrowbell." He looked uncomfortable. There must be a girl involved.
"Very well. I suppose I can whittle my gifts out of twigs or something,"
he grumbled.
Oh, don't worry, I encouraged. You'll have plenty of time to shop. You and Rondel. Huh? My other apprentice said when he heard his name. Master? Just after Yule, I revealed to them. You both will be going back to Sindaria Port, weather depending, and thence downriver, all the way to the Inarian Academy. I have used my influence to get you both special appointments there for individual training and assessment. I'd like to think I've done a decent job giving you the basics of Imperial magic, but the fact is your educations have been a little unorthodox, thanks to Sherul. Now that you are both nearly grown, are high magi, and are mage lords in your own right, you need more polishing. So, Rondel, you will spend 6 weeks at Inarian.
6 weeks?
Scoffed Tyndall, alarmed.
That's forever.
Then you will be there twice as forever, because I've arranged for you to do 12 weeks there, while Rondel goes to Relancor, to the War College, to get his own 6 weeks of intensive individual combat instruction. Then you will both do another 6 weeks of combined training under the finest war magi in the kingdom. They both looked appalled.
But Master,
Rondel said, his eyes wide with fear.
Why? Have we not given good service? Have we not?
It's not about your service, and it's not a punishment, I explained patiently. Look, you two are unique. You have power available to you far in excess of your skills. You've muddled through on cantrips and quick wits and brute force so far, but you both need additional training, and the cold fact of the matter is that I'm going to be too busy to provide it the way it should be. You both possess a strong, unblemished talent. You both have higher than normal intelligence, and you are both hale and hearty. More importantly, I said, in a somewhat lower voice, I can trust you, and that's going to be at a premium in the future, boys. We have power now, and not just magical power. We have political power, and don't forget that that's what doomed the Arch-Magi of old. Having power gains you enemies faster than a foul mouth, and power held unused is an invitation to the ambitions of your enemies. So, you're going to learn how to be my agents, I explained. I'm going to pack your skulls as full of magic and other skills as I can, and then you are going to do my bidding.
Don't we do your bidding now, Master?
Tyndall whined. I want you to do my bidding better. You need to be more effective tools, more effective weapons. You are mighty, but you are clumsy. But don't despair. If it was a life of lusty adventure you wanted, you're getting your wish.
That's not what I wanted,
Rondel insisted.
Tough,
I sighed. I never wanted to be a mage lord either, but here I am. The gods don't always give us what we want, nor do they always give us what we want the way we thought we wanted it. I wanted to be a spellmonger in a quiet mountain village. Well, my first attempt didn't work out that well, but this one, I'm hoping, will stick. I didn't imagine owning the place, but I'm finding it's helpful that I do. It's also helpful to have useful minions and intelligent, effective agents. I need a well-organized, strong leader like Sire Kay to be my castellan. I need a wily burgher like Bannermore to be my spell warden, and I need a thoughtful, considerate, and subtle wizard like Olmeg the Green to be my green warden.
So what will we do?
Tyndall asked, sullenly. You will do my errantry, I said. You will be my troubleshooters, eventually. Tyndall, I will want you to join the Horkan Order as my representative one day. Your skills as a war mage are impressive, and you have the kind of attitude they respect. Rondel, I'll want you to join the Hessian Order, where your talents will be helpful, and where you can be an effective representative for me. But that's not what you will do. What you will do is whatever I need you to do, and that's going to cover a lot of territory. This implies a lot of additional training, some of which you can't even imagine yet. But it is required of you, as it was me. So quit complaining and enjoy the winter in Sevendor, because come Yule, you both embark on fabulous careers as the spellmonger's dashing knights magi. Neither one seemed too pleased about that. Nor were they alone. Little Dara was scared about her future. She had gone from being a backwoods bird lover one week to being instrumental in an important battle the next. Now she was going to be my apprentice, and she didn't even know how to read yet. The tiny stone she'd won was attuned to her, but it represented more potential than power. Her mind just was not trained properly yet in the symbology needed to manifest her talent. That was a tedious process, but a necessary one, and she didn't look too hopeful about it.
Mage Lord, what if I fail?
She asked me after dinner that same night at Chepstone. You will, I assured her, repeatedly. Failure is where we learn, Dara. Don't be afraid of it. Just don't seek it, and you'll be fine.
So I'm just going to be a mage?
Oh, you'll be more than just a mage, I said with quiet enthusiasm. Your talent is special, my dear. Brown magic doesn't get near the credit it should, just like green magic, but it can be a powerful tool when properly developed, and there is much you can learn that you must learn to be a full-fledged mage yet. But your talent is strong. I have every confidence in your ability. And Dara?
Yes, Mage Lord?
Just to keep you busy in your free time, I've noticed that Sevendor Castle seems to be lacking a muse. Would you consider running one, if I had it built?
Mage Lord?
Her eyes widened. I didn't know a lot about my new apprentice, but I knew she loved birds. I had never considered hawking, as it was a sport of the nobility and requires a lot of money to do well. But then again, I was not just ennobled. I was filthy rich. A proper muse was something that Sevendor could afford. If it also gave Dara something to keep her busy, all the better.
I would love to.
I thought you might. Don't worry. I'll not send you away to school like I did Tyndall and Rondell. Your home is Sevendor. That's why I want you trained. When I cannot be there, I need it guarded by trusty magi. And clever magi, I added with a smile. That seemed to mollify her, and she ran to tell her father and uncles about her new appointment. We broke camp at dawn and continued on our way, not in a hurry, but not dragging either. The weather was just beginning to turn cold, and the leaves had already begun their change of colour, though they had yet to shed in great number. The whole countryside seemed aglow with red and orange and gold overhead, while plenty of green still waved in the wind. When we came to the former village of Ferendor, we were surprised to see villagers. Not many, but there were at least 5 families living in hastily assembled huts, preparing the settlement for winter. They were all Trestendori smallholders that Sire Siglan had persuaded to take residence here in the last few weeks. With them was the old but hale Sir Alsted, who led a 6 men-at-arms camped in the ruins of the old tower of Ferendor. It would be rebuilt, he assured me over a brief luncheon at the site, come springtime, and he would be its new lord, in fealty to Sigalan. Sire Sigalan was investing in the estate cautiously, but the new revenues from his regained estates and the new income from his red clay mine had given him the wherewithal to reclaim this once lucrative property. Sir Alsted spoke expansively about the great inn that would be built here. Indeed, Sire Sigalan was counting on the traffic between Sevendor and Sandaria Port to fuel the village's economic growth. We pressed on after noon, and passed through the recently conquered domain of Kest, under Baron Arathaniel's vassal. The people seemed well enough, and a few pennies and a pipeful persuaded them to reveal their thoughts about their new lord. Unsurprisingly, they were quite positive. The people of Kest had never loved Sire Gimbal the way that their lord had, and Baron Arathaniel had given wide amnesties to their debts and crimes. They were quite satisfied with the way things had turned out, even with the recent bloodshed. By late afternoon we had come to Sevendor. Not Sevendor Vale, but to the region that would eventually be known locally as Outer Sevendor, the domain of Bastador. When we approached the frontier, we were met with an honor guard sent by the Lord of Bastador, my new vassal. Nearly 200 men departed from my troops to return to their homes there, mostly peasant infantry. Their own full purses meant that I would have to do less to succor my new estate than I had planned. That's also where men from Carandal, Hosley, Hosendor, and Northwood also departed, and I gifted them each another ounce of silver as a reward for stalwart service. They were still wary about serving under a mage lord, but a few weeks fighting side by side with the Sevendori, after spending a few weeks fighting against them, had convinced these Riverlands men that the Wilderlands folk in the Blind Valley were not as strange or as foreign as they had been told. They could serve a mage lord, they had decided, especially one as open-handed as me. That was the secret to successful feudal politics, I was learning. Bribery. The last remnant of my troops formed up and excitedly began to march southward, toward their adopted home. They began to sing a lusty marching song to keep cadence, and someone had even produced a flute to accompany them. I pulled my mantle a little more tightly over my neck as a chill breeze blew, the smell of snow in the air, even if it was weeks before the first flake fell on the valley. I recalled the first time I had made this journey, only a year before. I recalled the decrepit state of the domain back then, as we came to Keta's stream, where several native Sevendori insisted on stopping for a drink for luck. It seemed like a lifetime ago, but it had been but a dozen moons, one full year. The differences were blatant. Where the dry, dusty slope up to the vale had been choked with weeds and despair the year before, now my nascent enchanted forest was covering the slope. On either side of the road and stream were scores of saplings, and a creeping green carpet of dangerous ground cover. Master Olmec himself was tending the forest when we arrived, swathed in a long green mantle, a straw conical peasant's hat on his head, his long pipe stem protruding naturally from his bearded face, like a branch of a tree. He leaned on his staff, his bare feet in the soil, and waved to us as we passed. Around him were a dozen or so river folk, most spreading some white soil around the floor of the enchanted forest from wheelbarrows or llama-drawn carts. "Mage Lord," the green mage said in his sonorous bass, a slight incline of his head expressing everything he wished to communicate. "Master Olmec," I nodded in return. "How went the harvest in our absence?"
"Nearly done, Mage Lord,"
he assured me, "nearly twice the yield I predicted. Indeed, we had to send 3 wains of potatoes north into the new domains, as we had no place to store them." "That's a problem I don't mind having," I smiled. "Are you liming the forest, then?" I asked, indicating the river folk's labor.
"Nay, that is snowstone powder,"
he explained. "I have collected a mound of it, and we are spreading it here in hopes it will help encourage some of the defensive enchantments."
"That's brilliant," I nodded thoughtfully. "I should have thought of that."
If the snowstone lowered magic resistance, there were a number of plants that were affected by the local magic field. Everything from rowan, holly and hickory, to weirwood and gallows oaks. Given that advantage, I could just imagine what kind of defense it could become in the future. We passed the enchanted forest and rode through the barren gap before the dyke tower, only to hear cheers from its ramparts the moment we came into sight. Those guardsmen who had been left behind were ecstatic to see their comrades and neighbors again, and I'd like to think that they enjoyed seeing me again, too.
"Do you remember the first time we crossed this gap, Mage Lord?" Sire Kay asked, as he pulled his horse even with mine. "I was convinced that we had been doomed by the gods with this place. I had not the wit to see its potential."
"Well, considering how much magic and how much gold and how much sweat went into its improvement, I don't blame you," I agreed. "Still, I'd like to think it was worth the effort." As we passed through the dyke gate to Bovol Hall, Tyndall took the opportunity to light up the tower with his mage light. The peak of Matten's helm stood boldly in front of us, the brand new village at its feet.
"There's an inn there now, where once there was an empty field. The granaries are stuffed."
"Look, Mage Lord," Sire Kay said, pointing up.
He indicated the peak of Matten's helm, where I could just make out something unusual. I summoned mage sight and amplified my eyes until I could see a small white structure taking shape, the Alcan Embassy, being built by their trusted stone folk allies. They worked quickly when they wanted to.
"Interesting," I murmured, "but not the thing I'm most interested in. Shall we head for the castle?"
"That's where they are,"
he said, and with more passion than I would have credited the man with a year ago. Marriage agreed with him. We rode through Gurisham, where the village men returned to tears and weeping. The village looked very different from a year ago, from the new construction to the rebuilt and augmented hovels of the Gurisham folk. The commune was doing well and prospering, it was clear. I waved, passed out a handful of copper pennies to the children, and kept riding. I was getting anxious. If Gurisham was different, one wouldn't have recognized Sevendor Village. In one scant year, the place had more than tripled in size. Where once a dozen hovels stood, Now there were 36 stout, well-built structures of brick, wood, wattle and daub, some roofed with thatch, but more and more roofed with more expensive but far more durable clay tiles. Sevendore Village was prospering under the weight of her newfound commerce. Bannermore said as much when he met us at the village gate, or where a gate would eventually stand. He rode a small brown mare and wore a long grey robe, with his badge of office around his neck.
"Welcome home, Mage Lord," he called merrily. "On behalf of the town of Sevendore, please tarry a moment for a drink and a blessing. It would mean much to us."
"Town of Sevendore?" Sayake asked, curious.
"As of a week ago," affirmed Bannermore, "there was a village council meeting, and it was pointed out that there are almost 3,000 souls within our limits now. That is far too big for a mere village. We are still hashing over the details, but we intend to write up a charter for you to sign, Mage Lord. I can assure you," he said with a wolfish grin, "you'll enjoy the terms. Your tribute will almost double."
"In exchange for?" I asked warily.
"Certain minor and incidental rights and privileges," he dismissed. "We can talk about it later, but I don't think you'll object. In any case, we sort of had to. The magical fair."
He trailed off. My heart sank.
"We lost money?" I asked.
Bannermore shook his head.
"The Mage Lord jests. We made close to 700 ounces of gold once expenses were covered. Most of that was on booth rentals and commissions, but we even broke even on admissions, and concessions were spectacular. I can't wait for next year."
Considering he paid himself a healthy percentage of the fair's take, I'm sure he couldn't.
"What the hell are those?" I asked,
after stopping at the tavern on the commons for a drink and a few moments of camaraderie with my men before they were mustered out of service. There were 3 new construction projects on the north end of the village, town, that had sprung up while we were gone.
"New homes?"
"In a manner of speaking,"
Bannermore said slyly.
"You remember last year when you granted Jurlaw the right to rent the 3 lots closest to the village?" "He did. The one to the west is rented. To the Guild of Enchanters."
"Who the hell are they?" I asked, irritated.
"An ad hoc group of spellmongers and resident adepts who are mad about Snowstone and the properties of Sevendore. They formed in the tavern during the magic fair and leased the space from Jurlaw at a handsome price. Next to it is the new tower complex being built by those Ramiran friends of yours. The Order of the Hidden Fortress?
Secret Tower," I amended. "Planus and Penny's dad."
"Really?" "Apparently they were unimpressed by the amenities offered by the castle," he said diplomatically. "I helped broker the deal, but Lady Pentandra insisted on establishing a presence for her father's order here in Sevendore, and she found the space acceptable. They plan on a 7-story tower in the Ramiran style. It should be finished in just a few years, provided they can get the artisans they need."
"And what about that one?" I asked, pointing to the eastern lot, where surveying work was just beginning. "Don't tell me Sharul wants his own embassy to Sevendore."
"If he did, I'd charge him double," Bannermore assured me. "But no, that lot will soon be the home to the local chapter house of the Arcane Orders. Also Pentandra's doing, I'm afraid. I meant to discuss it with you and get your approval, but Jurlaw insisted he had the right to lease it, and then you were at war, so..."
"Well, I can't argue with that one," I sighed.
"I was wondering just how we were going to house all the folk bound to drop by Sevendore in the future. If the Arcane Orders have their own chapter house here, I won't have to put them up at the castle at my expense," I reasoned.
"That was Lady Pentandra's thinking," he agreed. "She's a remarkable woman," he added unnecessarily.
"Yes, she is," I said.
I didn't need to add anything to that. When we had concluded our brief stop in the village, we continued around the pristine white-bottomed lake that now reflected the gleaming white walls and castle shining in the sunset. I let out an expressive sigh as we began the last leg of our journey. The Westwood men took their leave at the track that led to their holding, little Dara as excited about seeing home again as I was. Almost. Of course, the gods could not allow me to enjoy the anticipation of seeing my family again unfettered. Just as we approached the great, white, gleaming wall of my castle, I felt the annoying touch of a mind-to-mind contact. I would have rejected just about anyone's thoughts just then, content with my own. But the source made me answer.
Yes, Iyugi, I asked my magical spy. You have something to report.
I do, Mage Lord,
the former foot wizard told me. I have tracked the woman to Wensha. I have found her. She and her baby girl, mother and daughter, are doing well, if the birth sister who tends her is to be believed. They are at a castle in northwestern Wensha, near to the frontier with the wildlands of the Colleens, a domain called Noradeth, in the county of Voronsha.
Excellent work, Iyugi, I answered.
Find some way to set a watch on the place without alerting the lady within. I trust you can manage that.
If the Mage Lord can afford it, he answered.
Spend what you need, I ordered, and then hurry back to Sevendor, when you have ensured that she cannot leave without our notice. I have other need of your services.
As the Mage Lord wishes, Iyugi is your humble servant.
Iyugi was more my slave than my servant. His dignity had slipped appallingly when I had given him his witchstone as a reward for his skills at ferreting out other people's secrets and keeping my own. He had danced like a little child, so gleeful was he in his newfound power. I had had to temper that enthusiasm with my dreadful oath, but he had accepted the terms of our arrangement without discussion. If being my sworn man was the price of power, he was more than willing to labor in the service of the spellmonger and take my coin. Thus far, Iyugi had proven utterly trustworthy. I hoped I could continue to count on that. Having him track down Lady Isali's whereabouts and the status of my illegitimate daughter had been his trial run. Now I had even more serious work for the spy.
I can hardly believe we're back,
Sire Kay murmured as we crossed under the gatehouse, where a new snowflake and star banner hung. It seems a lifetime that we left.
So it was, Dragon Slayer, I said, slapping his armored shoulder heartily.
A dragon's life. But we are back, and I could not be more content. I banished all worry about the consequences of my wartime liaison from me. This was a time of joy. There were only a few score of us now, the men who lived and worked in the castle. Their womenfolk had gathered in the bailey in front of the gate awaiting them, and they broke into loud cheers as we mounted the rise. It was a small little castle, far less grand than those I'd seen lately, but I loved it. From the snow-white walls of its keep to the stately old trees in the yard, from the depths of the well to the peak of my personal tower, I realized that I loved this little castle in a way I had not thought I could love a mere place. Sire Kay and I stopped our horses in the bailey and handed off the reins to stable boys, before being enveloped by our loved ones. Alio was in my arms and on my lips the moment my boots hit the white dirt, slobbering on me, soaking my mantle with her tears, filling my ears with her laughter and joy. Lady Estrid was mauling her new husband like a panting teenager, her daughter grinning wildly and giggling over their antics. When I finally let Alia go, reluctantly, it was only because I felt a tremendous desire to hold my son. Only when I had his pudgy little body in my hands again did I feel the last bit of anxiety slip away, the last bit of immediate worry fall. He was hale and healthy, fat, pink, and stinky. Everything I could want in a son. I let out perhaps the most expressive sigh I've ever made. I began to take my wife's hand and drag her inside when I realized something was left undone. As the veil began to sink into twilight, the sun disappearing behind Cowland's Pass in the west, I raised my hand and snapped. Instantly, a great green mage light formed over my tower, painting its white stones in an unearthly, magical glow.
Daddy's home,
I announced, and in the distance, all the way across the commons and the lake and over the wall, I could hear the people of Sevendor village cheering. The Mage Lord had come home to Sevendor, and tonight, at least, all was at peace. And as if to answer me, the god sent the first snowflake of the season early, the beginning of the first light dusting of the season. I chose to take that as a good omen. It was the Mage Lord's prerogative. You have been listening to Mage Lord, Book 3 of the Spellmonger series, produced by Greg Lawrence, Associate Producer Emily Durr. Text copyright 2008.
2013 by Terry Mancor. Production copyright 2017 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. If you enjoyed this audiobook, let us know. Take a quick moment to rate and review it on Audible, so we know we're bringing you audiobooks you'll love.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.